Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios of CBS Interactive is my co-host, Fleischmann Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
And today's regular guest, PhD's Chris Stevenson.
Hey there, Tim.
This week, 2GB runs its first TV ad campaign in a decade as the battle for talk hots up. The call goes out for bigger ad file sizes. Do Aussie kids watch too much TV? My Kitchen Rules start strong for seven. Barry Mazowski, to head up Starcom Creative Strategy. And Westpac's stereotyped ad gets the all clear. So it's been a few weeks since you've been in, Chris. It was before Christmas, I guess.
It was well before Christmas.
So what's been going on in the world of PhD since we last spoke? You've been pitching Unilever.
Been pitching, yes.
How did it go?
You know that I can't talk about that.
Yeah, but I had to ask because I'm
a journalist.
Of course
you got to ask.
Yeah. What else have you been up to?
I can go as far as to say that we still don't know yet, but it's just been the most amazing journey for us. It's just been a privilege to be in the pitch list, really. It's great for a company of our size and duration of time in this market to be in that list. So it's been a great journey for us.
And what's in the public domain is that the other agencies also on the list were the WPP agency Mindshare, and I can't remember whether it was Initiative or Universal. It was Initiative, wasn't it? Yeah. So this is a subject we'll talk about in future weeks, but I'm not going to make you uncomfortable by talking about your pitch. So tell me what else PhD has been up to.
So it's just been a very busy few months for us. Lots of pitching besides that. We continue to grow, and we've had a very successful end of last year, Campaign Asia Australia Media Agency of the Year, and also Network across Asia Pacific. So PhD performing well across Asia Pacific, and also Omnicom doing well globally. So
and position, pipped at the BNT Awards since we last spoke, though,
pipped,
I'm afraid.
Pipped, yes, but you know it's great to be nominated.
It was a battle between you, Mediacom, and Icon. Icon picked it up.
Icon picked it up, but it was.
And as I said to all of the people who were shortlisted, I would have voted for you.
But you said to everyone, Tim.
Exactly. Whoever's in the room at the time, yes.
Media slot, Tim.
No, they're very, very happy to be commentated.
And this year, what are the kind of goals for PhD this year?
I think for us it's about maintaining growth. It's about continuing to work with our clients to evolve their business as well as ours. And for us it's really start to get more involved and more plugged into Australian media. The media scene is just evolving so rapidly around us, and PhD should and could have a strong voice in that.
And some personnel changes as well. Mark Holden has moved to the global strategy role, which I guess also made room for Toby Hack to come in as MD, and a new head of trading as well.
That's right. So our glorious leader is now even more so glorious leader from Higher Than Network. Brilliant for us. PhD's first global strategy director. So
did you
brilliant
see, by the way, the story in Campaign in the UK, the profile of him they wrote? Astonishing. It was actually like...
Was it astonishing?
It was astonishing. It was like Jesus had returned to the UK after a couple of years away. It was possibly the most flattering profile I've ever read of someone. And, wow. And they don't give flattering profiles very easily. So how has the sort of structure changed to make room for that then?
I think the structure's growing. I think it's less of a structure change and more of structural growth, really. So I think that the network now is of a size and stature that it can have a global strategy director. So Mark's now in that role. Brilliant for us that he is. And brilliant for us that collectively, as PhD across the globe, we've now got that resource and that leadership in Mark.
Okay, what about Toby Hack has come in from Nine?
Yeah, that's brilliant. So brilliant to have Toby in. Brilliant to have someone with that much experience from the other side of the fence as well. So a great person and a great asset within the agency.
And tell me about Lucy's appointment.
And brilliant that Lucy's coming across as well.
Everything's brilliant today,
so
isn't
everything,
it?
Do you know what? It's like it's smelling of roses at the moment. It's good. It's kind of got Toby in. Mark's in a great role.
So Lucy's come across. Lucy
Formosa Morgan over from... So she was senior at OMD and is now across and working with us and heading up our trading.
OMD being a sister agency.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's get straight into it. Next, we talk about Alan Johnson being back in advertising. So Sydney radio station 2GB has launched its first TV advertising campaign in more than a decade. Now, created by Mojo's Alan Johnson, a famous name, the Joe in Johnson, or he was once Mojo, not for many, many years. He also sang in the ad. The campaign is going to run across all three commercial networks with a spend of something like $1 million. Let's have a listen.
Fat cats, bureaucrats, pink bats, carbon tax, NBN, faceless men. Oh, here we go again. Refugees, bank fees, tax cheats, WikiLeaks, Iraq, Iran, another scam. Soldiers in Afghanistan. Run goes, greens grow, cracks show, party woes, rising rents, budget spent. Wonder where the surplus went. Electricity, families feel the squeeze. Climate change, crowded trains, hospitals feel the pain. You are the power, we are the station. You have your say, and we'll tell the nation. 2GB, the power station.
So Scott, we're back to the old days of the jingle. And what I thought was quite interesting was the very first comment that went on to the comment stream was along the lines of, the trendy creatives will hate this, but it's probably right for the older audience. What do you think of that style of advertising? Musical ads?
I think they've got their place. They stick in your head sometimes, that kind of thing. But I think the old rehashing a classic song, I'm not a fan of, to be honest. Because you're more likely to remember the original song rather than this rehashed version.
Well, of course, Amy was inspired by the latest Amy one with everyone prancing around, and the cheerleaders was inspired by her hair, wasn't it?
And as I've said to many of my friends, that when I get a chance, I'll be leaving Amy due to those adverts.
Really?
Yeah, I can't stand them. They're so irritating. Every time I see them on TV, I just want to vomit.
I found myself humming it the other day, though.
Oh, jeez. But we discovered that you're incredibly susceptible to ads. We've discovered this in the past.
Well, that is true, yeah. Chris, talk radio is a obviously, one of the reasons this is happening is 2GB, very dominant station, but 2UE gearing up. This week they've sort of officially unveiled their new lineup, this sort of younger generation. Is it sort of for all advertisers, talk radio?
I see no reason why you'd discount it. Per se, I think like any planning, it's about finding relevance. It's about finding the best and most appropriate places and spaces for the messages that you have. So, talk radio does offer a great platform for the right campaigns, especially with editorial integration, and especially when there are opportunities to go beyond the spot ad and to engage with the presenters.
I remember, and that might be the kind of key point. If I remember seeing a blog post from Tim Pethick, who sort of gained a bit of attention as the sort of founding marketing director of Nudie Juices, but now does Sultry Sally, the chips. And he went on, maybe 2GB, maybe 2UE, one of the talk sessions, must have been 2GB, I think, and wrote this blog post on just the amazing response of how they just flew off the shelves, purely because it's the voice, the presenter that the listeners trust so much. When they say go and buy these chips, and they you know, obey and go and buy these chips.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure it's the Pavlov's dogs necessarily, but I do think that there are quite powerful connections to be made when you have very trusted presenters on talk radio being advocates for products. And I think that the right integration and the right connections can work incredibly well in those platforms and in those environments.
Scott, you look thoughtful at that.
Yeah, just about those crisps. I was thinking I've not seen them in a long, long time. I don't even think they were still around.
There's a point to be made on the return of the jingle. I've been anticipating the return of the jingle for quite a while. I think that one of the biggest challenges facing any advertisers or anyone seeking to communicate in the current environment is one of saliency, and cutting through was an incredible amount of clutter with fragmentation and on-demand communications, and the sheer volume of communications out there. Saliency and cut through becomes absolutely paramount, and jungles are an absolutely brilliant way of doing that. And I've been expecting a whole tranche of jingles for a good while now.
And it's almost not
so your fault then.
I don't think it's with me. But I think in many ways you could look at something like the Intel sound. It's a bit of a jingle, an evolved jingle. It's that sound, that thing that will immediately be a cue to recognition.
And is that almost it? So it's sort of, to use a vaguely pretentious term, the sonic identity, as opposed to a cheesy jingle. Is that how it will kind of evolve?
I think it'll become a mix of the two. And I think that what's interesting is I think there might be more of the people involved in this instance have gone more for the old school jingle style. But I do think that sonic shortcuts will become really important.
I can agree with that, but I think if the ad's irritating, then people are turned away from it. It doesn't matter if it's a jingle or not. I think if you're going to make an irritating ad that annoys people will walk away.
Well, next, media owners call for bigger ads. So Australian advertisers are pushing websites to create bigger ad file sizes so as to allow for more creative ads. The campaign is called the 100KB Project and is being led by Amnesia Razorfish's Ian McDonald. So this is a relatively technical debate, really, which I've found myself sort of rapidly learning about this week, despite the fact that we have ads on Mumbrella, so I should know about it
already. What's your ad size on Mumbrella?
We can take up to 50 at the moment. So until very recently, the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, had a limit of 30KBs, which they've just moved up to 40 in line with the rest of the world. But the argument being made by creatives in digital is, if you let us do 100, we can do so much more, so much sumptuously, and we'll start delivering our copy on time. I'll start delivering our final ads on time, saying that at the moment they discover at the last moment that they just can't create what they wanted to create.
I think my main problem at the moment with this is that the press release or the statement from them said, you know, with the NBN coming, well, do you know what? The NBN's quite a bit away. I said, I don't mind you going on about the NBN. Do you know what? Fine, come up with 100 kilobyte ads when the NBN rolls out, but don't come up with it now when people are still struggling with a lot of bandwidth issues.
One of the arguments he makes is that your typical web page may contain 1,300 kilobytes.
Well, I don't want it to contain 1,400.
So the ad within that is maybe, you know, might only be an extra 6 or 7% if you increase the size.
But what if there's two ads in the page or three ads in the page? You know, then it's 6%, 12%, 18% of that bit of the size.
Chris, I guess from the media agency's point of view, where this comes in is when the ad agency is late to deliver the ad and the campaign can't start.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of the things we've got to contend with, one of the things that media agencies have got to manage. I do think it's an interesting statement to say that that we're producing ads that are too big, and if you increase the file size, we'll deliver on time.
They'll just make bigger ads after that. They'll just say, we need 200.
Yeah, I think they'll say, now we're going to make mini movies, so we need a megabyte. But I mean, I think that...
And in fairness, generally the rules change for video.
I mean, I think there are formats out there that can take bigger file sizes. There are plenty of platforms that exist in the online space, be it Rich Media or various others. That can take the bigger file sizes. I mean, if you want to create really engaging or more engaging communications, then you can make mini video and have a YouTube channel. We're not short of opportunities online. That said, I can see both sides of the argument on this, and I can see that the creators want to strive to make every connection as engaging as possible. I do think, though, the comment from Paul Fisher is interesting when he says that...
Paul Fisher, the CEO of the Interactive Advertising Bureau.
The IAB, he says, we remain to be convinced that the most efficient way of achieving the goal of better quality of creative is with a larger file size. Mm. And I do think that alongside file size, if we can continue to strive for things like relevance, creativity, and purely adding utility to people's lives rather than advertising at them, might find...
I suppose this is the question. In terms, you know, where, I guess, you, PhD, as a media agency, loses the... So it has to hand over the problem to somebody else, is when it comes to the quality of the creative, because you can have the best planning in the world and presumably the success of a campaign might be altered by what, twice, three times, ten times if the creative is great or terrible. Are there sort of metrics around that?
There was a very recent study by the Gunn Report and the IPA in the UK, and Peter Field, I think, worked with the Gunn Report and established that creative campaigns and creatively awarded campaigns are more effective. So those campaigns that are more creative and more engaged with and more talked about are more effective, full stop. So there's definitely a link between the two. But I think that going back to the point of media agencies ceding control, I think that what this is about is having agreed and across the board lockdown roles for communication. I think that the more different agencies who are working on a brief can really understand and agree and crystallize the role for communication, then the more creative is going to deliver on that.
Yeah, I think it's that fusion of areas and departments all working together. I think that we need to see more of that. There's and we spoke about this last week, where I said that, you know, public relations is very much left out a lot of the time. It seems like PR's the last thing that a lot of companies come to when they realize so they've got the creative, they've got the media spend. And then they go, shit, what if nobody looks at our ads and everyone, but people need to find out about it. And, you know, the amount of briefs I've had land on my desk with companies, you know, with market managers saying, look, we need you to help us promote this brief. And I'm like, and here's a budget of $5,000 or here's a budget of $10,000. And I'm like, well, your ad spend's 1.8 million. And you come to us with $10,000 and say, we need your help.
Well, this is a question, I think, probably for both of you, is that thing of also, what do you do when you look at another component of a campaign that's not come out of your agency and your team that's no good, you know, whether it's bad creative or whatever, how far can you go with the client, for instance, and saying to them, look, this isn't going to work. We just don't think it's good enough.
I think you tend to avoid that, and I think you should avoid that. I think that once you've got to that point, there's little to be served in repercussions and to point the finger to say that something was or wasn't as good as it could be. I think the answer lies in much more long-term and medium-term thinking and getting everyone involved upstream. I think that it's not about responding to bad work in the short term. It's about taking it on the chin collectively as a group of agencies and as a client and saying, how can we get everyone involved as upstream as possible so that the work we collectively produce is more aligned and more coordinated?
Would you ever say, though, this isn't good enough to run, for instance, or, you know, strategically we should start again?
I think that'd be a very big call for a media agency to make. I can imagine extreme circumstances where if the viability of a significant spend was, in our opinion, severely compromised, then that's a conversation we might have.
Have you ever had that sort of conversation in the past yourself?
I've been fortunate enough to generally be in situations where the dialogue's been good enough throughout the process, where we can nudge and cajole and negotiate as we go along to make sure that the what gets produced is ultimately as aligned as best possible with the intention of the media plan.
Scott?
Yeah, I've been involved in one situation, and I waited till the campaign was over, and I just spoke to the person involved and said, look, you know, I have to admit that I wasn't happy with this part of the campaign simply because it didn't fit in with the rest of it. It looked like they'd just come up with an idea. You guys, somebody in your organisation thought it was a great idea.
And why did you wait until afterwards?
Because it was already created and done, and it was. And as usual, PR was pulled in too late to actually be able to influence it. And otherwise, you know, if PR had been pulled in at the beginning, I would have gladly stood up and said, that will not work.
See, I worked on a magazine in the UK where I sort of sat next to our sales guy. And a couple of times I heard him on the phone to clients saying, look, you know, just to let you know, this ad you sent us, you know, he put it more diplomatic, but frankly, he was telling them it's not very good and might not be that effective, which I suppose he was also covering his own back if he didn't deliver, you know, his product didn't deliver the response.
I think there's a responsibility for everyone involved to feedback and to make that constructive. And I suppose it's a question of how constructive is feedback if it's too late to do anything about it. Clients aren't daft. You know, clients know. If I went up to a client and said, by the way, I don't think that execution was as good as it could have been, that shouldn't be new news to a client. I'd be amazed if any client that I said that
really?
To was surprised by that.
You see it from our end.
This is the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. For more on these stories and more, head to mumbrella.com.au. Coming up, Aussie kids love television. So a survey out this week by Roy Morgan Research shows that young Australians, and they count those as aged between 6 and 13, spend on average 14.2 hours watching TV each week, which by my maths is more than 2 hours per day. Now, what was really interesting by this survey, and it was a decent-sized survey, a decent-sized sample, was just how far ahead TV was on online in that relatively young group.
This is the kind of survey that makes my blood boil. This just makes me really angry that the level of simplicity that's being applied to this is really rather staggering. To look at two numbers and say that TV is twice as consumed as online almost makes a nonsense of how we can start to understand how these people are consuming.
Now, one thing in defence of that survey is very cleverly what Roy Morgan do is they press release the top line data and then they make available the full report for...
$10,000?
Yes, I think it was $9,950.
Did anybody get a hold of it yet? Can you send it to Tim Burrows at Mumbrella.com?
Yeah, well, if everyone's got that report.
Yeah, but you know, it's clear it's a loss leader, isn't it? But the funny thing was after we published the heading, I actually had emails from two different media agencies saying, oh, can you send me a link to that full report? And I kind of said, well, this is where you can find it, but it is that amount, and they say lost interest.
My thing about it was, and I didn't see the actual survey yet, so I don't quite know the results. When they say watching TV, do they mean watching television, using a computer on it, or do they mean accessing video games on it?
Someone did clarify on that. It does mean watching television as in TV shows, not playing gaming, and that's sort of, right, okay. So not using it as a screen. So, yeah, somebody from Roy Morgan did come back. Somebody asked that question in the comments, then they came back. So, Chris, the point you make, why, though, does it make your blood boil so much?
It makes my blood boil because if you talked to a 10-year-old and said, talk to me about TV or talk to me about online, they would have, I think, difficulty understanding the question.
Yeah.
That they wouldn't separate. They're surrounded by screens. They're surrounded by TV. They're playing games on TV screens. They're increasingly going to be able to watch and consume online versus TV. They watch TV online. Mm. We've got to change the terms of the debate. We've got to change the definitions that we're dealing with.
For a 7-year-old, TV could be YouTube. I mean... You know, it's as simple as that. The TV to them could be moving pictures.
Yeah, but I think to give Roy Morgan credit, they will have done some things to remove, you know, some of that noise around it, I'm sure.
I just find for knowing Australia's social media consumption, for knowing how much time... I mean, I've seen like 12 surveys that state that Australians spend more time online than Americans.
Yeah, but remember,
Americans.
This is 6 to 13-year-olds.
It doesn't matter. God, kids these days run about with their phones, run about, you know, I think that...
Chris, what were your media habits as a 10-year-old? Do you remember?
It was a lot of books, which isn't actually on here at all.
I think I would have called that as a bookish young man.
A lot of books, but a lot of TV as well. I was a ferocious TV consumer when I was a kid. I was a ferocious gamer as well. My Spectrum ZX +2.
And were you in
I was a Commodore man, you loser.
And were you in a commercial television house or a public broadcaster house when it came to television?
Very much across the both. Very, very happy Friday afternoons with Philip Schofield
and
the Broom Cupboard.
He's a silver fox now, isn't he?
He certainly is. Dancing with Dancing on Ice now.
This is painfully British for...
sorry, everyone.
Terribly sorry, yes. Yeah, terribly sorry.
There was plenty of Henderson Kids and plenty of... I mean, Neighbours was a stalwart of my...
Neighbours was... Yeah, that was... Well. A,
and
Charlene
has it,
and
by
Scott
the way, did. That Thunderbirds is on the way back.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can't beat that.
I heard Captain that on the Guardian Media Talk podcast last week, actually. They may mention that. And maybe depressing, maybe just typical. Magazines and newspapers less than an hour a week for... 6 to 13.
Maybe that's because most of the magazines and papers these days aren't worth reading for longer than 10 minutes.
Chris, you look sad at that prospect.
I'm not sad. I think that what you're looking at on those figures is the future.
There are tween mags though.
Yes, there are, and they have a valuable role in many a schedule. But I think that you look at those figures and you see the writing on the wall, and you see the future, and this generation will grow up with screens. And in the week that The Daily was launched and that Murdoch announced that is the future of newspaper publishing, I think that it is a very pertinent time for anyone.
The Daily being News Corp's big iPad play, which has been launched in the US, $1 a week, big team, you know, probably
huge,
one of the
dollar a week. I don't know how much you're going to recoup there.
800,000. 800,000 subscribers will cover running costs, but 30 million has been sunk into just making this happen. So, so a phenomenal investment.
You've been reading
for them.
Jeff Jarvis's analysis, haven't you? And as I think we all have the
Richard
Ramakis.
but yeah, I think that it's a very pertinent time for anyone who's in paper publishing, when they see those figures, to think about where their business will be in 10 years' time.
The thing is, you look slightly, you almost like an expression of crossness came on your face, Scott, when we mentioned the Daily. Yet, isn't this exactly what, you know, this is a big publisher investing big in something
that's
the future. But what's wrong with that? You know, you might be sceptical, you know, but you look more sceptical.
I'm just always sceptical with Murdoch. It's as simple as that. You know that. I know how much, how many front pages were changed, you know, because a certain political bent wasn't there. That's my issue with that kind of thing. I still think that, you know, newspapers should be free from that kind of, I guess, oppression or puppet play is what that's my only problem with it.
Just keep changing your voicemail PIN number, Scott, and you'll be fine.
Hello, Andy, you out there?
Yeah, interestingly, by the way, we had a chat with Neil Breen, the editor of the Sunday Telegraph here in Australia, on the Mumbo Report this week. In fact, we'll play a clip of that at this point.
You mentioned privacy and, I guess, just the pressure of story getting. Big story out of the UK at the moment has been the phoned, celebrity phone tapping scandal. Could you ever see that happening in Australia?
No, I couldn't. Look, I followed that really closely, and I think, you know, that comes out of that hotbed atmosphere in Fleet Street. There are so many newspapers over there, you know, so many daily newspapers, so many Sunday newspapers, and the competition is so fierce. I think one real positive we have on newspapers in Australia is that we don't pay for stories. And that was the mistake I made with Pauline Hanson, because we pay for, we'll buy photos. But what I did with Pauline Hanson was I bought more than a photo, I bought a story. And that was where that whole business fell apart. So I think that there was that culture in the UK has led to that trouble. Honestly, I've looked at the editors over there, and a lot of them saying they didn't know about it. I look at it and I go, gee, if people on my staff were phone tapping people, I'd know about it. I just would, as editor. You get a good instinct for where journalists are getting stories from and how they're coming across their information. But I really don't think that would happen in Australia, and I think it'd be sad if it did.
So that was Neil Breen being fairly sceptical about his sister paper in the UK, The News of the World, and whether, in fact, the editor wouldn't have known about the phone hacking. We have touched on this very briefly, but Scott, from what you know about newspaper culture, does an editor, for the big stories, does an editor always know? Like, for instance, when you're on The Sun, would the editor have always known the source of your story?
98%, yeah. Well, if not the editor, the news editor. And the news editor in his weekly meeting will say something. I mean, if you're doing something illegal, you better pretty much tell somebody about it, otherwise, you know, you're out of a job. But if you're covered and you say, look, this is how I'm getting that, if it's interest in truth and justice and all that kind of stuff, then that's fine. You know, if it's in the public interest, then go ahead. But I couldn't imagine only the journalist knew. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, that's a British story, and we've been going quite British today, so we won't spend too much time with that one.
I mean, you're not going to say tickety-boo?
Well, I always say tickety-boo.
I mean, just jump back to the story on this. I mean, to give credit to Ryan Morgan, it's great that this survey exists. It's great that this data exists. And I'm all in favour of the freemium model. But I think that it almost does more damage than it does good if the free part is simplifying the debate to such an extent.
Well, it's quite the paywall, isn't it, at that price of a report. Next, still with television, we talk about the kickoff of the ratings season. So the official ratings season actually kicks off on Sunday, but 7 and 9 have kind of got things started with a bit more pre-season competition than usual. 7's My Kitchen Rules kind of led off with a couple of decent ratings, both around 1.2 million on the Monday and on the Tuesday. And then 9's new show, which they always put a squeak in, but is based on the Twitter feed, Shit My Dad Says, that came in close behind for its debut with a 1.183 million. So, Chris, your instincts about the coming year, and probably there's a declaration of interest in that. I think, PhD, you look after 9, don't you?
We do planning work and strategy work with Channel 9.
So that's 9 as a client when they're promoting themselves.
Absolutely, yes.
So you've been busy
with them.
So internally, do you know it as Shit My Dad Says or Squeak My Dad Says?
I think you'd probably say shit. I don't think we'd say squeak. We might say bleep, My Dad Says.
Yes, maybe bleep.
Bleep,
then.
Bleep,
yeah,
bleep,
so,
bleep, My Dad Says.
But certainly
says.
When, you know, the billboards and everything have always just had, you know, stars and asterisks and,
yeah.
And stuff. But wearing your, obviously you also and spend most of your day job advising clients on where to spend their TV money, where do you see the networks this year?
This is a really strong year. This is a really, really strong year. And I think that it's the same as always. You know, it's kind of like we've got 3 very strong networks performing really, really strongly, 10 performing really, really well. So I think there's no doubt that 7 and 9 have come out fighting as a result of the strong performance of 10 in its first week.
So 10, obviously, they've launched their spin-off digital channel 11 over Christmas. I think that was on the 11th of January, if I remember rightly, which has seen Neighbours and The Simpsons move across, and that's gone okay.
Performing very well. I mean, we saw in the figures this week beating 7mate by not an inconsiderable amount, and Go as well. So if there's a story, I think, for this season, it's now those offshoots and those sibling stations really coming into their own and seeing the growth of those offering channels and really seeing Australians embrace them and seeing Australians embrace that choice that now exists in the market.
Now, once the digital switchover has fully happened, and it's as you know, there isn't the analogue advantage for the old stations. Can you see the day when one of these new digital channels will beat one of the mainstream channels, apart from SBS One, just in the normal run of things on a, you know, cold Tuesday night?
I think once there's a level playing field from consumption, I can absolutely see that might happen. I think that it's totally viable to imagine a scenario one day where you get a particularly strong programming lineup and a particular weak programming lineup on a main channel, and you see a flip.
Where does this leave SBS then? So they're partly publicly funded, some advertising funding as well, nowhere near the budget of the ABC, but still this sort of public service, you know, bringing all of Australia's multicultural stories to all of Australia. Where does it leave them as these digital channels all come past them in terms of audience? You know, what would it take you to advertise, to persuade a client to advertise with SBS, for instance, when it's got smaller audiences?
I think what it will take with any smaller audience, it's less about reach. I mean, media planning these days
isn't
about
it?
Reach. Yeah, I mean, I think that this obsession with reach has really, really got to be wrestled with now. It's not about volume of reach. You know, we can get volume, we can get reach. It's about quality of engagement, about relevance of programming, and it's about making the right connections. And I think that SBS has got one single task, and it's a task it's had for a while, which is to define its place in the world and then really single-mindedly go after that.
Now, you briefly mentioned 10 being strong. What else is driving 10? I guess MasterChef will have another big year.
MasterChef have a big year. We've seen a really strong start for the year for Biggest Loser as well. So a really strong start to the year with that.
Have you had a chance to watch George Negus, 6 p.m. with George Negus yet?
Yes, not
yet.
Good.
Yeah,
it's better than expected, to be honest.
It is, yeah. They kind of put a relatively tentative sort of 500,000, you know, kind of target audience.
Yeah. But he brings he brings gravitas, I think. And, you know, and he actually gives him a little bit of credibility, which is unusual.
What I noticed one night this week, actually, and I'm by no means a typical viewer, was because obviously 10 have now got this big run. They do the 5 o'clock news, then they do 6 with George Negus, then they do the 6:30 news, then they do the 7 p.m. project. Whereas over on 7 and 9, you've got the news on the hour at 6, and then you've got the Battler programmes, A Current Affair, Today, Tonight, 6:30. I noticed one night this week, I was in the office and just missed the 6 o'clock news, so it was about 6:30, 6:35. And the only news alternative for me at that point was the 10 News. So, you know, I found myself watching that for the updates on the cyclone and stuff. And I found myself thinking, you know, that, you know, this idea that actually so long as they can just attract enough of the audience who want news at the time, then that might be an okay strategy for them. So instinctively it started to feel right. But am I extrapolating too much from myself?
I don't think so. I think there was a theory that a weaker news offering going into peak was going to weaken peak, and we're not seeing that. We're seeing a very, very strong peak. We're not seeing that lower volume of viewership of Ten's news offering affecting peak. Peak's performing very strongly.
Now, the other headline in the last few days has been Charlie Sheen, rehab, possibly far fewer episodes of Two and a Half Men this year.
That can only be good for the world, to be honest.
Well, you say that, but you know that I think is perhaps dangerously snobby in that it's one of Nine's best performing shows, so the Australian TV audience obviously
likes it. It's
not definitely
snobby. It's definitely honest. Learn the difference.
Yeah,
seriously, it's not snobby. I just think it's a crap programme.
You're just being elitist, though,
no,
aren't
I'm not
you?
Being elitist. I just think it's a pile of crap.
Chris, is he being elitist? Should you respect the choices of your consumers?
I'll tell you why.
I'll
even tell you why it's not being elitist. Because the same guy does, the same producer does a Big Bang Theory, which I think is brilliant.
That rates very well for guys.
I just think that Two and a Half Men is a despicable show.
Which rates reliably for Nine?
I think two things. I think TV is inherently conservative, and I think that if a programme is rating, it will stay rating until something conspires to end it. I also think that TV abhors a vacuum, and I think that if Two and a Half Men produces less episodes than it might have done in recent years, then there will be great shows out there that will fill its place.
I think they've already said they're going to commission extra shows of Mike and Molly, which I think is another Nine show, isn't it? And I suppose the other thing is, if it ever dropped off production, you know, rather like at the moment they have loads of, you know, repeats as well, and it fills out and they rate okay. The moment Friends went out of production, the repeats dropped in value as well. Presumably the same would happen with Two and a Half Men.
I'd have thought so, but I mean, I think that if Two and a Half Men drops off the schedules, there doesn't seem to be a shortage of great shows coming through to replace it.
Okay, and then we should briefly talk about Seven as well, and how they, what sort of year you see them potentially having.
Things are looking good for Seven. They've got some good shows coming up. They're performing really, really strongly. We all know this is a sex story.
Neil Breen said the other day? There's always a scandal going on somewhere. It's just whether you know about it or not. What have you let
everyone knows about the sex story. We also know at the same time about the success story that's been happening in several recent years. So you know they've got a great programming lineup that continues. Seven Mate performing very, very well, started strongly. So things are good for them.
Do you know, you're such a consummate media agency professional. Every one of the media owners is your friend.
Don't look at me, I'm happy about
I thought you were about to jump
in. What I'll say is I'm disappointed that I don't think any of the TV stations have picked up Community yet from the US, which is a shame.
Community?
Yeah, it's one of the best shows I've seen in years.
What's the synopsis?
A disgraced lawyer has to go back to community college to get his degree, I guess, in the US, and it stars a group, have a study group, and you would not do that if you watched it. It's half hour comedy.
It's a very strong ensemble lineup. So yeah. some
Chevy
great
Chase is in it.
Chevy Chase, yeah. But a great ensemble cast performance.
Yeah.
Speaking of ensemble lineups, HBO. Their big thing, Boardwalk Empire. Has anyone picked that up in Australia yet?
I don't think so. Not aware of.
I'd sort of expect it to pop up on Showcase or something like that.
Fairly criminal that it hasn't. I think that if I do have a problem with the networks, it tends to be that a lot of the homegrown tends to be derivative, it tends to be reality, and the shows that they do pick up from elsewhere tend to be very mainstream and
very
not
generic.
As challenging as they could be. And I think a show like Boardwalk Empire deserves to be broadcast, and someone needs to pick it up.
Well, next, a new face at Starcom. So, following a few Australian media agencies, Starcom has appointed a creative strategist, and I'll just take one run at the name and try and get it right. Barry Mazowski, previously at Ogilvy, so previously from an advertising background, also from Droga 5 in New York, which also has an Australian outshoot, but probably the New York offshoot is the better known and the more certainly creatively awarded offshoot. This idea that every media agency needs a creative strategist, Chris, what
You're trying to justify his role?
Well, I'm not. Firstly, I was going to ask whether you describe yourself as a creative strategist, but it's the way you're kind of openly laughing as I use the words that that suggests you. Maybe I'm reading a lot into it.
No, but I'm just laughing about Channel 7's sex story. I think it's a smart move for an agency to diversify its offering and to give an extra dimension to what it offers clients. How agencies choose to do that will define them, and it's an interesting move from Starcom to bring someone from a creative background. I wouldn't describe myself as a creative strategist because I haven't got a background of a creative agency or an advertising agency.
So is that a gap at PhD that needs filling, do you think?
Well, I think that as the world evolves, all agencies have got areas they can evolve. The question is, which areas do you want to evolve into? And I think that for PhD, there are areas closer to home that we would look to expand into before perhaps creative. Things like social media, things like software and app development would probably be an area that we'd go into first. You know, as software becomes the new medium, that's like much closer to home that we can be evolving into.
And when you say app development, so literally having developers on staff who can knock up something that's relevant.
Social media, really? Shouldn't that be led by communications?
Well, that's another debate. We're not going to have that debate right now. What I would ask, though, Scott, is that...
Seconds away.
Yeah, Chris's point on agencies kind of evolving. What sort of... At Fleischmann Hillard, is there anyone there who is from a non-PR background?
Me? I'm a journalist. globally, yeah, globally. We've got 100... our digital department, we've got 165... in our digital department, from search engine optimization, search engine marketing, we've got web builders. You know, we've got every form of digital, I guess you can have, all in house in a sense, because we realise, you know, that whole movement from an aspect of the business from public relations to content relations is the kind of future for a lot of agencies.
Well, next,
just one last point in that, I think it's worth making, which is that I think we too often see agencies making this kind of appointment and expecting to be defined by what they say they are. I think that agencies are defined less by what they say they are and more by what clients actually want. And I think that what clients want is actually much truer reflection of what agencies become. So what I hope and expect to see is Starcom taking their clients on this journey so that they're part of the evolution of that agency, like any agency should.
Spot on, yeah.
Next, Westpac's gay stereotype. So a Westpac Bank ad has become one of those talked about ads, I suppose. It's been given the clear from the Advertising Standards Board regarding complaint that this couple was something of a stereotype. So that was the complained about ad, but the Westpac, the Advertising Standards Board, in the end decided that, yes, it was a stereotype, but it was okay nonetheless. What did you think of the ad, Chris?
We've heard every excuse in the book hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm. I'll have the money for you on Friday.
Can I pay you half now, half later?
Checks in the mail.
We didn't think we had to pay that.
Your local Westpac bank manager and team can talk business at your place or ours.
I was at the Easter show.
To help get cash into your business faster and keep it there longer.
It's great that you're at the Easter show. I can't even afford to go because you haven't paid.
Mm-hmm.
We talk expert solutions, whatever your conversation.
So, Chris, that was the ad, which Westpac defended it, saying, since launch, we've had some resounding positive feedback with very high preliminary awareness and recognition figures, especially from the gay community, who've embraced the humour and its intent and congratulated Westpac on our depiction of these characters. Others in our comment stream more complained that it was rather too similar to characters in the movie Best in Show. What did you think of the ad?
I think they're absolutely right to defend it. I think that it's a funny ad. I think it entertains. Is it a stereotype? Yes, absolutely. A lot of advertising is based in around stereotypes. It is a shortcut to people. It allows us to quickly get a sense of who the characters are. It is stereotypical. I personally don't find it offensive, and I think that they're probably right to defend it. And I can see how that would be appreciated and laughed at by the gay community.
I've noticed that the Ad Standards Board a couple of times has almost started their resolution with, okay, it's a stereotype, but... So another one that we've written about this week is the Sellies ad, which has got the kind of the handyman with the housewife kind of flirting with him, and then as she goes out there and he turns to the camera and says, would you really want me in your house doing this? Shouldn't you be doing the DIY yourself? Or something along those lines. And that's been cleared. And again, the resolution on that one was... Okay, it's a stereotype, but...
I think my issue was that it was just, do you know what? She's going to cheat on the husband. She's going to cheat. When I watched that, that's the only thing that came across my mind was, I just went, if she's, you know, that's a simple process of it. If she loves her husband and doesn't want to cheat, then she won't cheat. If she does, it might not be the handyman, it's going to be someone else.
Well, finally, we move to any other business. So, Chris, what have you been up to this week outside of work? What have you been watching?
I've emerged from my pitch cocoon to actually catch some movies that I have been meaning to see for a while. And I saw the rather delightful Catfish last night, which I thought was a cracking movie and a very interesting bit of movie making off the back of Social Network and this idea that the social media incarnation of the internet is now really... The extent to which it's predominating and entering the mainstream with movies like Social Network and like Catfish, really exploring the nature of social media and the identities we can create from
and
it.
And Catfish is, and I haven't seen it yet, but I understand effectively it's the tale of boy meets girl via social media and then they get together and it traces the whole story. And there's some speculation on whether it's real or not.
Yeah, it's a story of boy meets girl caught in the context of a documentary. And as you might expect, things don't turn out to be the way you think they are. I won't say anything else.
No, don't tell me the twist.
I won't say anything else. But yeah, it's a very interesting bit of filmmaking.
And Scott, any other business from you? What's been annoying you this week?
I think Channel 7 annoyed me this week when they were covering the cyclone, Cyclone Yasi, and they had a countdown to when it was going to strike, which I found a bit wrong, personally. I thought, you know, if you're going to... I understand you doing it for New Year. I understand doing it for events, but I really don't understand you doing a countdown for, you know, a disaster. That's pretty bad form. And, you know, on Twitter, there was I must have seen about 500-600 people in my stream all complaining about it. You know, and if you had any touch with kind of your
Hang
average
on.
Person.
How many million times have I told you not to exaggerate? I don't think I've ever seen 500 or 600 people complain about anything.
Have a look at Twitter yesterday. Just do a search for Channel 7 and you'll just see screeds and screeds of people. It was just across all my entire feed. There was a point where it was like 15 people just in a line all complaining about it.
I was expecting to see Jeff Goldblum pop up with a laptop and it's clicking top going down any moment while the hurricane appeared overhead in the skies.
Well, that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest, Chris Stevenson.
Just a very quick hello to Jason Isaacs.
And also to CBS Interactive for use of their studio. Production was by Georgina Pearson. For these stories and more, head to mumbrella.com.au. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.